Around this time last year, thousands of people flocked to Washington, D.C. in what would become a historic march for women. The march occurred on the first full day of the Trump presidency, and let's revisit the sound from the protests, courtesy of C-SPAN coverage of the Women's March in Washington 1 year ago.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what a feminist looks like.
This is what a feminist looks like.
Show me what a feminist looks like.
This is what
ready to go.
Fired up.
Ready to go.
Sounds from the Women's March on January 21st here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Farrah Stockman is national correspondent at the New York Times. Her piece this week looked at the fractured state of the Women's March organization. It's titled, 1 Year After Women's March, More Activism But Less Unity. Farrah, welcome to the morning show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Sunday marks the anniversary of the Women's March, and before we dig into where the movement stands today, can you give us a refresher on what were the goals of the Women's March?
Oh, that's a tough one. So, first of all, there's more than just one Women's March. There was a huge march on Washington, D.C., but there were more than 600 marches all over the country, and there were other marches elsewhere in the world that were held in solidarity with the Washington March. And so, you know, they really wanted to throw their arms wide open and embrace a lot of different communities. They wanted to talk about Black Lives Matter. They wanted to talk about undocumented immigrants. They wanted to stand up for marginalized communities that have traditionally been ignored by mainstream feminist movements. So they really, you know, their goals ran the gamut, and I think that's one of the difficulties a year later in assessing how well they did and also in trying to make something more unified out of all these decentralized groups that either planned marches in their own communities or sent buses to Washington, D.C.
So a year later, there are challenges with the Women's March and what it means and who's in charge. What are some of the dynamics going on?
Well, I just want to say that there is something really positive in this, which is that 3 million people marched last year, and there's no way one group or one organization could have made that happen. I mean, it was really bubbling up from the grassroots, people in their communities, organizing their own communities. Every major city had a march, and then there were tiny marches in, like, the mountains of Appalachia. So there's no way that one group could have ever done that, or that one group can even control all that now. So the successes are that all of these women are energized and they feel very invested, and they did this work unpaid, many of them holding down a job and a family, and then they planned these marches or they organized buses. And so today they're using their networks to go after politics, to elect officials. They're repurposing their email list to elect candidates locally and on a more statewide basis. So I think those were the successes that I was seeing. More women running for office, people who had never been involved in politics before jumping in. So that is, I think, one of the points I wanted to make. But there is sort of a disagreement, if you will, over the strategies and even the goals. Women's March, Inc. is the group that planned the march on Washington, D.C., and they really view themselves as the leaders. They have continued to issue sort of instructions for people who marched, and only one of the 10 instructions they issued in 2017 had to do with elections. They said, make sure you're registered to vote, make sure your friends are registered to vote. But a lot of people thought they were too focused on protesting, and their actions were like, okay, go to a vigil for Syria, or form a circle in your with friends in your neighborhood to create a safe space for undocumented immigrants. And I spoke to a lot of women, especially women in red states, who said, okay, we tried that, and it's not really working. We're not really getting anywhere because we don't have elected officials who care if we protest or not. So we want to go for elections. We want to make sure we're electing people who care what we think. And so there has been a move by people who planned the sister marches across the country to create a new organization called March On, which then focuses much more narrowly on getting people elected, especially in the months before the midterms.
Which brings us to January 21st. There is a march on Las Vegas, or a rally, perhaps, in Las Vegas. Why there, and what is the goal, and who's in charge?
So that is planned by Women's March, Inc., which did do the march in Washington. They are now turning their attention to politics, and they are rolling out sort of a voter registration drive in swing states. They're starting in Nevada because they say there's a lot of immigrants there, and it's a swing state. There's expected to be a close election there. So that's where they're starting, and they're going to go to other swing states to sort of put a national spotlight on registering voters and expanding the vote. So I think that they have been pushed to go towards politics, and now they're really embracing it. So now these two groups are less different than they were, let's say, 6 months ago.
Farrah Stockman is with us. She's a national correspondent at the New York Times. We're talking about the Women's March 1 year later, where it stands today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you participate in the Women's March last January? Are you planning to participate once again on the first anniversary? What do you hope would come out of this protest? Is it making a difference? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Farrah, the goals of March On versus Women's March, it's, you know, we've been hearing there is this fracture, differences, who's in charge. Does it really matter at the essence who is putting on these protests?
I think at the local level, it hasn't had a huge impact, because I think local activists are not being paid by either group, and they are just seeking resources wherever they can get it. So if they can, you know, coordinate with Women's March, Inc. and get some national attention for their march, then that's great. Or if they can go to the Women's Convention, I think Women's March, Inc. put on a very well-received convention for women in Detroit, and a lot of activists went, and a lot of activists got training there, and they got scholarships. So Women's March, Inc. has more money. They have the media spotlight, and they've filed a trademark, so which is pending. So if they win that trademark, then they get to control who uses the word Women's March in their names, I guess. I'm still trying to get more information about that myself. But I think that it matters when local activists on the ground are told, hey, you can't call yourself a Women's March because you're not going along with the stuff that we have said is our agenda. And I think that that's why it matters. If somebody takes ownership over this movement, which was really created, you know, from the ground up, from the grassroots, almost spontaneously, then I think you're going to find some tension. But if Women's March, Inc. finds a way to work with local activists and without sort of claiming too much ownership over the name, then I think it won't matter quite so much.
Farrah, before we let you go, what are you looking for? What do you anticipate out of rallies and marches on Saturday and Sunday?
Well, I think this is just a chance for people to build a network. And a lot of people who go to these marches get energized. They start to consider themselves activists. They go back to their own communities, and they start participating in things in a new way. We've seen this after every major march in American history. People return home and think of themselves differently. And so I think that's the most transformative power of these marches, besides the fact that women, particularly in places that don't have huge liberal communities, they go home with a network. They go home with email lists and phone trees, and they can actually start to organize according to their beliefs. And I think that those are the real successes that come out of marches.
Thank you, Farah.
Thank you for having me.
Farah Stockman is a national correspondent at the New York Times, joining us to talk about her coverage of the state of the Women's March as it nears its one-year anniversary. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you participate in the Women's March? Are you planning to participate again on the first anniversary? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. We'll return after a news update. There are hundreds of events planned across the nation and around the world to mark the anniversary of the 2017 Women's March. We're looking at the Women's March 1 year later on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Women's March organizers have created a new event this year called Power to the Polls, to be held in Las Vegas on Sunday. Let's bring in Karen Beckwith. She is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Case Western University in Cleveland. Karen, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. I'm pleased to be here from Case Western Reserve University.
Well, we talked earlier this hour with New York Times reporter Farah Stockman, who reported on what some see as a rift as the Women's March movement continues, specifically about different priorities and tactics. One group, she reported, spent most of the year creating more social justice protests, and another, which planned sister marches last year, thinks winning elections should be the primary goal. What do you make of this split and where these tensions arise?
I think that we risk making too much of a split. I wouldn't use that term to describe what's happening. There's been a common historic tension in the women's movements among feminists who, on the one hand, want to engage the state and are interested in electoral politics. Certainly the women's suffrage movement was part of that wing, so to speak, or that campaign of the larger women's movement. And then those that challenge the state and remain autonomous from the state and are less interested in electoral politics and more interested in social justice issues, in employment issues and labor relation issues, in race and ethnic issues. And so this is a common historic tension in the women's movement that we can see for more than a century. And I'd also add that this is not unusual, not only for the women's movement, but for the women's movement in other countries and for other movements in the United States. So, for example, during the Black Civil Rights Movement, there was considerable tension between the nonviolent resistance strategies of, for example, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and ultimately the more confrontational, more radical, less electoral orientation of, again, for example, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So I wouldn't make too much of this in terms of a split. It's an historic tension that we see across multiple social movements. The turn to electoral politics I find particularly interesting because this is not just happening in the United States. It's happened elsewhere under similar conditions. I'm a comparative political scientist in doing gender and politics, and it's been interesting to me that during the Thatcher governments in Great Britain, where the Conservative Party governed with large majorities in Parliament, feminists who had been autonomous from the state and not particularly engaging in the state and using a more disruptive protest-oriented strategy, turned to engaging the state in electoral politics. And they also turned to engaging a sympathetic party. It was at this point that not only feminists turned to engaging with the state through electoral politics, but they also engaged with the Labor Party. And the Labor Party began to make major internal changes in their attempt to come back into power, but also to respond to the feminist challenges that came within their own party and also from outside the party. So I see a similar thing happening in the women's movements right now, that the emphasis on the emphasis on politics, on electoral politics, now that we're a year into the Trump administration, it seems to me it's following a similar pattern. It becomes clear that there's a government that's very hostile to women's issues and to women's interests, that is not only not willing to engage positively with those issues, but is rolling back gains that women have made in the past. And so this kind of electoral shock often, or it seems to, wake up political movements, social movements, and make them more electorally focused.
Do the movements flex with the challenges of the day? Do their goals shift over time based on what they have to address at that given point in time?
I think that's an accurate statement. Certainly goals shift. They shift in regard to context. They shift in regard to the nature of the state and who's governing. They shift in regard to their ability to interact with other social movements. So the women's movement is engaging women all over the United States. That's clear. The first women's march took place, my understanding is there are marches in every single state in the nation, and, of course, a very, very large one in the District of Columbia, and a very, very large, unanticipatedly large one in Los Angeles. So we have a large, large women's movement that was mobilized a year ago. And this involves lots and lots of women, and women are a very diverse constituency, so to speak. And so all of those women involved in the women's march bring with them their commitments to race-based movements, to ethnic minority-based movements, to the LGBTQIA movement. All of these movements are brought in as people are bringing their own issues that are important for women, but also that intersect with other issues. So it's very complex. It's clear that organizing across 50 states and the District of Columbia in a large, diverse country with a history of racism and sexism is very difficult to do, but it's not impossible. And so I see these things as not a split in the movement, but a very, very large, diverse movement intersecting with other social movements, trying to bring itself to bear on the politics of the day.
Let's bring in a call now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Steve now, who joins us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, one of the questions that was asked before you went to break is, how are you going to use the movement? And I have two young daughters, and I'm going to use the movement similar to what I did last year, where I'll show, you know, YouTube videos to my daughters of certain politicians that you're just being ripped on, whether it's Sarah Palin or Condoleezza Rice, and demonstrate how these types of women were not included in the women's movement. So this movement really isn't about empowering women. It's about certain types of women and only certain types of beliefs. And it's really a political issue, not so much as wanting to have women be free thinkers. They have to march lockstep with a certain ideology. And I want my daughters to be free thinkers. And if they follow a path down a certain way, I'll support them. If they follow a path down a different way, I'll support them as well. As long as they're free thinkers and don't mark lockstep with people telling them how to think.
Steve, thank you for that observation. Karen, your thoughts?
Well, my thought is that that's actually not correct. So the first thing is the Women's March involved lots and lots of women of many different political preferences and many different orientations. So women came to that with issues concerning reproductive rights, and they came to that with issues that had to do with women's political representation in Congress and in state legislatures and in governorships and seeking political office. So I don't think this is a large, diverse movement, so the ability of any single group, No matter how big and powerful or no matter whether they have incorporated at the end of their name, can impose upon other women a particular strict agenda. I watched some of those marches, especially the one in D.C. and the one in Philadelphia where my daughter was, and there was no lockstep there. There were just masses and masses of women raising these issues. It's also the case that women of all political parties are interested particularly in women's political representation. And so among conservative women, among Republican women specifically linked to the Republican Party, their virtual exclusion from Congress in terms of their party, in terms of their access to candidacies, has been a serious issue for them. And so I would just say, I would just encourage Steve to have his daughters look at all the good examples and all the good examples of women who might reflect his ideology who are struggling to get into office and make their issues known as well.
knowing what activists sought to achieve and the chants you heard last year, what do you see as the successes, and what do you see where the challenges lie in what needs to be done with what the protesters want?
So I think there are two challenges. The first is, I think to be successful, this has to be a long march. This has to be a march of many, many years. The strategy that brought us to a United States where the Republican Party has overcome the Madisonian separation of powers and controls the majorities in both chambers of Congress and controls the presidency, and although it's intended to be nonpartisan, also has considerable influence in the courts. So it will take a long march to undo that overcoming of the Madisonian separation of power. So first is a long march. Secondly, I think a protest strategy of the kind that the women's marches are doing is crucial. It's needed to keep activists mobilized, and it's needed to keep policymakers and politicians aware of the support for a variety of issues that the women's marches are advocating. And there are many issues, and some of those are in conflict with each other, but nonetheless, a protest strategy is necessary. A protest strategy is very difficult to sustain over a long period of time. So that's a big challenge. And then the second is an electoral strategy. I think the women's marches and March On and the variety of different intersecting movements need a coordinated electoral strategy to work with a sympathetic party that can be positioned to be supportive and responsive to the women's movement and that can respond to the challenge and that has incentives to do so. So right now, the Republican Party has no incentive to respond to this in the sense that they've successfully captured the majority of seats in both chambers of Congress and the presidency. The Democratic Party has much more incentive and is ideologically better positioned to respond to the demands of the Women's March and the Women's March more generally. And I don't want to just say the Women's March. There's a wave of campaigns that are part of larger movements that, this is perhaps a little too strong language, that are struggling to find their political position in regard to the state and in regard to the U.S. government. And so this includes campaigns and phenomena like Occupy Wall Street, certainly like Black Lives Matter, most recently the hashtag MeToo and Time's Up campaigns. So an electoral strategy is going to be necessary. It won't be sufficient by itself, and it can't be, and it can't take place independently of a political party. So I see these as the challenges: a long game, a protest strategy, and an electoral strategy.
Karen Beckwith stays with us. She is the Flora Stone Mather Professor of Political Science and Chair of the Political Science Department at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Talking about the Women's March, the 2018 Women's March is framed around a national voter registration tour ahead of the 2018 midterm elections. We're looking at the Women's March 1 year later and the state of the feminist movement in America. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you hope would come out of this protest? Have you seen it happen? How would you rate the movement thus far? What challenges do you think the Women's March faces as it moves forward? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Karen, we've had some Facebook conversation from Kelly, who says one thing that resulted from the Women's March is that women found their voices again. The Me Too movement is evidence of that. What do you think?
Oh, I agree. I agree.
In what way?
Stop.
Karen, how do you see the women's movement and Time's Up as a reflection of the Women's March?
So if the question is the reflection, the Women's March is a reflection of the women's movement, I think it's a very good reflection of the women's movement insofar as it involves a diversity of women, which means, which actually does reflect the women's movement more generally, that informs the tensions that the movement's experiencing right now. But I wouldn't say that they're, again, I wouldn't say that they're more than tensions. I think that it's a good reflection, and it's a good historical reflection as well. The Women's March is using the tools of the suffrage movement, which involved lots and lots of suffrage parades. It's certainly using many of the tools of social movements and organizing protests, not disruptive and not violent, but certainly, well, disruptive in the sense that basically the Women's March in Washington, D.C. shut down the city. But I want to turn just a little bit, if you don't mind, to thinking a little bit about how social media has helped to mobilize the Women's March. This is something that was mobilized fairly quickly. I wouldn't say necessarily spontaneously, because the women's movement has been there, and women have been active across the last several decades and longer. But the 2016 election offered an opportunity for the Women's March to mobilize. And social media makes it easier to mobilize movement events. It makes it easier to publicize those events, and it makes it easier to coordinate movement campaigns. It also, it seems to me, has a downside, which is that it makes it easier for movement campaigns to fragment and to proliferate. It may be that under circumstances of social media, it may be more necessary to brand the movement, so Women's March Incorporated, as a means of protecting the movement and its organizers and its participants of good faith from the possibility of trolling, the attempts to hack the movement, or to disrupt its organizing efforts and its mobilizing efforts. So I've been interested in social media in this regard. But the Women's March appears to have used social media very successfully. It's created what appears to be, we'll see if the long game works, to be an annual linking event that brings together multiple campaigns and multiple activists. And this allows the Women's March to show strength in numbers. It allows the Women's March to show the range of support across all states and to publicize issues and to mobilize people for the next step.
Let's bring in Marcus, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. Go ahead.
So I guess my question or comment is what your guests' thoughts are about possibly enlarging the movement to be more inclusive because, and by more inclusive, I mean bringing men in because I'm all for strong females and the empowerment of women. I have two daughters like the previous caller, and I'm trying to, you know, take these moments as teachable moments to educate them and show them, you know, that they can achieve and they can be whatever they want to be. But I also feel that, you know, when you get a larger coalition and you bring more movements together, you create a critical mass where it can't be turned back. And I feel that it's slightly remiss to not necessarily invite men in to also support this. And I guess I was just wondering what your guests' thoughts were on what the role of men could be,
Marcus,
to accomplish that.
Yeah, Marcus, thank you. Karen, go ahead.
I think that's a really interesting point. And it's certainly the case that men have been supportive for example, the Time's Up campaign, and publicly willing to say so. And that, I think, has been very, very helpful. There are lots of ways that people are involved in social movements. I understand when a social movement wants to hold, I'll use the language, an exclusive event that wants to make a public statement that's literally embodied by the participants.
And we need to
understand.
We need to pause right there because we're up against a check of the news here. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234, talking about the Women's March, what it means today. Join the conversation back after this news. Last month, Emily's List, a national women's group, said that more than 25,000 women have contacted the organization about running for office since the 2016 election. In the months prior to the 2016 election, the group has said roughly 1,000 women expressed similar interest. How much is this due to the organized effort of the Women's March? We're talking about it. This year's Women's March official event is titled Power to the Polls, foreshadowing the emphasis on voting and the midterm elections. Karen Beckwith stays with us to unpack the movement. She is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Case Western Reserve University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you participate in the Women's March? Are you planning to participate again on the first anniversary? Call in, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Karen, with the statistics cited by Emily's list, how much do you think that is due to the energy coming from the Women's March?
I think it's come in large part from the Women's March. There are a variety of points in time where we can see where women have entered electoral politics as candidates, contesting for nomination and primaries in large numbers, the most notable of which, of course, was in 1992, the so-called Year of the Woman, when for the first time women's representation in Congress as a result, in the House as a result, moved into double digits. But the other thing that's, I think, pushing this is the difference between the two parties. And I think it's had some really interesting effects. I don't have all of the data at my fingertips, so you'll have to forgive me for a moment. For the Democratic Party, it's clear that there's an easier route to nomination if you're a woman. And that, I think, has not only opened the door for women, but the Women's March has certainly heightened the interest and the possibilities of women being candidates through the Democratic Party. There's an interesting push and difference on the other side, which is the Republican Party has not been good about helping women get through primaries. The numbers of women who ran for nomination by the major parties in 2016 were not substantially different, but the outcomes of the primaries gave lots of advantage to Democratic women. Now, some of that's just the incumbency effect. There were already more women who were Democrats in the House, and so those incumbents are coming back through primaries with success. But the numbers of women making it through primaries in the Republican Party have declined. And I think that has actually heightened now because of the Women's March and because of the push on the Democratic side, interest among Republican women contesting primaries and seeking office. So there's an interesting effect. There's one party that's not doing a very good job, but certainly doing a much better job than the other party. And that means that for the party that has fewer women coming through primaries, it's given women in that party a stick to beat the party with. Why can't we do this? And I know that there are efforts. I know that one of the Republican contenders for the nomination for governor in Ohio is organizing an event that targets women and that's focused on women and that is recruiting women as the audience.
Let's go to
the Women's March has done a lot.
Let's go to Michael now, who joins us from Lake Geneva with a question. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. I wanted to, your guest organization, the Women's March, on its official website lists a partnership with the Council on American Islamic Relations. Any concerns about partnering with an organization with links to Hezbollah and that promotes Sharia law in the United States?
I can't comment on this because I don't know that organization, and so I'll just have to be silent on that issue. I will say, though, that it's obvious that the Women's March and other organizations like other mass mobilizations like this are going to involve lots and lots of people. And so we'll get to see people from the labor movement. We'll get to see people from the environmental movement. We'll get to see people from Black Lives Matter. Lots and lots of people will be involved in this.
Michael, thanks for the question. Let's go to Dick in Middleton. Hi, Dick.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, just a comment, I guess, and maybe a little question regarding last year's march and wondering what impact a lot of the negative things about that. It was so disrespectful. I thought one day after inauguration, it was more of a protest on Trump than it was all your women's rights. When you see the lunatic like Ashley Judd, I mean, urinating on a poster.
So, and Dick saw this as a referendum on the Trump presidency. Karen?
I think it's much more than that. Again, I think the election was a triggering event. The current president lost the electoral vote by multiple millions of votes, not just votes garnered by his opponent, but by others who chose not to vote for him, even though he was the nominee of their party. And so I think that was the triggering event. But the platform that the party came in with and the comments that the president was making as a candidate, including his recorded comments about sexual assault, certainly mobilized women in this country. So I think it's much broader than simply focusing on the president. But that election was definitely the triggering event.
One of the terms that's come up in these discussions is the phrase intersectional feminism. Can you explain for us what that means and where that stands today?
I'll do the best I can. Intersectional feminism is the appreciation that women are diverse in their life experiences, in their social structure, so to speak, in terms of where they live, what their life opportunities are, what their life chances are, and that requires an appreciation of all women of those differences to be able to move ahead. This terminology came out of Black feminist political theorists, including obviously Kimberly Crenshaw and others, Anja Marie Hancock, Julia Jordan Zachary. I know I'm going to be missing lots and lots of names, so people, Nicole Alexander Floyd. So people have to forgive me for not mentioning all of the issues. And it turns primarily on differences first heightened meaningfully and clearly by Black women of Black feminists.
Let's go to Peter now, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. I'm just there are so many things that I think are wonderful about the whole Women's March, but I understand that the 2016 election was kind of the tipping point of when women felt empowered enough to, you know, band together a little bit more strongly. But I wonder if I just hope it's not going to be something that fizzles out because of the sexual assault cases that are happening. And I wonder what type of processes do these organizations have set forth to kind of continue the ball rolling in the direction of, you know, maintaining power and getting their voices heard to a more broad audience.
Peter, thanks for the question. Karen, go ahead.
Well, I think this remains to be seen. There are obviously links of Women's March organizers and activists with established organizations like Planned Parenthood, the National Organization for Women, the NAACP. Labor unions are involved in this. So there are structures that exist that of which activists in the Women's Marches are members. But it does remain to be seen. I think this was a big question for Occupy Wall Street. How would there be a continuing structure which would undergird a movement forward of Occupy Wall Street? The same, I think, is the case for Black Lives Matter, which has been more successful, I think, in being able to provide a structure that allows forward movement. So, again, this remains to be seen. We'll see what happens with these women's marches. We'll see what happens with the 2018 elections, not only in terms of their outcome, but first in terms of who the nominees of the parties are.
Peter, thanks for the call. Let's go to one more call here. Karen in Black Creek. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I just wanted to share my reflections as somebody that was at the Women's March in Madison last year. I went with my two sisters, with my 18-year-old niece, my 19-year-old daughter, four of my daughter's friends, all but one of us had never really been active politically before. I'd never been in a protest march before. And things that happened in last year's election, it was not for me so much about Trump as it was about feeling like our voices were not being heard, and it was time to stand up for ourselves and say enough. Listen to us. We have concerns. And the breadth of signs that people had, the different issues on their minds, it was not all about strictly women's rights. It was about all of the things that mattered to us. This year, I have participated in another march. It was about stopping sulfide mining. I've called my representatives, which I had never done before, and so have my daughter and her friends and my niece and my sisters. And if anything, I think it has woken us up as citizens, not just women, but as citizens, that we have a voice and we have a right to speak up.
Karen,
thank you.
Yeah, Karen, thank you so much for your observations. I want to bounce back to Karen Beckwith here. Your reflections on Karen's evolution, becoming politically active, coupled with what are you watching as the effort to build this movement continues?
Well, the first is I just want to say, Karen, thanks so much for your comments. I think those, I think your experience is a really common experience in regard to the Women's Marches. Women who have not been in protest before, who have not been politically active in that way, but have been politically interested, who have been paying attention, suddenly feel that enough is enough and they have to physically manifest their concern about all of these issues. And Karen is also absolutely right that there were many issues that were brought in. So women from the environmental movement were in those marches. Women who had been primarily but not exclusively in the labor movement were in those marches. Women who have very specific local concerns were in those marches. So I think this is quite exemplary of what mobilized people and also what made women so happy to be in those marches, to see all of the diversity, but also to see other people like them who were concerned generally and wanted to evidence that. So, Kate, I'm sorry, I've forgotten.
So what are you, as we wrap up here in the last 15 seconds or so, what are you watching for as this movement carries on?
Well, I'll be watching for a similar, happy, massive, interesting, diverse set of women's marches all over the country on January 20th. There are 8 that will be held in the state of Ohio that I know of, and maybe more that I haven't found yet. So I'll be watching those marches, and I hope they'll be just a wonderful, fierce, happy celebration of all of the issues that women are trying to bring to the fore.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us. Karen Beckwith is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Earlier, we spoke with Farrah Stockman, national correspondent at The New York Times. We've been discussing the state of the Women's March and the state of feminism in America. This hour, The Morning Show was produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Chasso, Nyasia Ellison, and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.